call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Tuesday, March 10th. Good afternoon. So first off, for a couple of announcements, we're going to carry over the hearing on House Bill 2850 to Thursday. And also, we are not going to work House Bill 2578 in this session. With that, I'm going to open. Is Representative Witt here? I don't see.
Session is in.
We'll have to wait, so he's not here yet. So let's. Is Frederick here? Is Aaron Deves here? I'm trying that. Okay. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3062. Aaron, if you want to go ahead and come up, and Wendy will give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3062 exempts prepaid transportation cards from the Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act and related statutes, and also from provisions related to regulation of gift cards that have expiration dates. The measure has been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and there are no amendments before the committee.
So I see Ed, did you want to come up as well with them, since you're all three in the same position? Go ahead and come up. All right, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, Vice Chairs Bueller and Rayfield. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3062. My name is Aaron Deves. I'm a government affairs manager at TriMet. Today with me is Chris Tucker. He's our director of revenue operations at TriMet, and his group's in charge of rolling out our upcoming e-fare system, which is the subject of this bill. Considering that his knowledge far exceeds mine, I will hand it over to him to let you fill you in on the details. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the House Committee. First off, I'd like to thank Representative Doherty for helping bring this bill forward. My name is Chris Tucker, Director of Revenue Operations at TriMet in Portland, Oregon. And TriMet provides public transportation service throughout the greater Portland metropolitan region. I'm here as a project leader for an electronic fare system, or e-fare for short, and to request approval of House Bill 3062, which will allow TriMet to retain all the fare revenue it collects today. As a background, I'd like to explain how TriMet currently collects fares and contrast that with the proposed e-fare system, which TriMet plans to implement in 2016. E-fare is a payment system that will better serve our riders by allowing them to pay as they board a bus or train with a transit debit card. Instead of fumbling with cash or needing to purchase a pass at the grocery store, customers will simply take their card and tap a validator as they board the vehicle. The system also has a myriad of other benefits, such as balance protection in case someone loses their card, the ability to reload value online anytime, anywhere, and less waiting time because they can streamline boarding process of simply tapping and boarding. To support this new way to pay, the system creates a transit account for the customer, and they can store money in that account for future usage, similar to a bank account. The system tracks usage, which allows riders to verify their charges and the balance remaining on their account. Our e-fare project is similar to the electronic fare projects and systems implemented in Seattle, Salt Lake City, and San Francisco. Like the transit agencies in those systems, we have encountered a problem with the way state law treats unused fare revenue and propose a similar legislative solution. So the problem. Because cash and paper fares are valid at the time of sale today, TriMet recognizes the revenue at the point of sale and retains it as our fare revenue. Unlike the current fare system, the e-fare system in the future, TriMet would not record the fare as revenue until it's actually used, until they tap the card and use it. Because the unused balance on an e-fare account is considered unearned revenue, it would be subject to Oregon's unclaimed property law and would escheat to the state after a certain period of inactivity, which means TriMet would lose that revenue to the state of Oregon. The solution to this is House Bill 3062. Modeled after similar laws in other states, House Bill 3062 would exclude transit fare card balances from the unclaimed property gift card statutes. Thus, instead of losing unused fare card balances to the state, TriMet would retain the revenue for public transportation in a manner similar in how it retains all fare revenue currently. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I'm curious, annually, how much revenue is left unclaimed on these cards?
Representative Stark, we don't currently have any electronic media, so everything is paper purchases are made.
So this would be a whole new...
A whole new system.
Okay, so it's not in. Got it. Sorry.
Other questions? Do you want to ask that?
Yeah, and just...
Go ahead, Representative Rayfield.
And actually, I was just thinking about this. Currently, the money would then go back to the state, go to the Department of State Lands, and then be put into the Common School Fund. Is that correct?
I'm not certain how it would be used once it escheats to the state, but it would go to the state of Oregon. I believe that's correct.
Yeah, that is my understanding.
Okay.
Representative McLean?
Well, I believe that we had a discussion on you folks turning to this type of an e-system. And does this just take care of the unclaimed portion?
Representative McLean, that's correct.
Okay.
This is just
so
focused
just
on
their companion bills, right?
I
thought you guys were going to go to an e-system as far as, and so has that already gone into place? No. So that's another endeavor.
No, that Representative McLean, we're in the process of working that system out, and this bill would address a future problem once we roll this system out in 2016.
Okay.
So we're in anticipation of our system.
Right. So this just helps set that up.
Exactly.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just on a technical point, because Representative Rayfield's question I think confused me a little bit. So because you don't actually receive the funds until they use it, if there really aren't any unclaimed funds, right? Because so someone loses their card and there's a balance left, you haven't actually received the money because it hasn't been actually used.
Correct.
Where is that money? So they paid somebody, but then you haven't received it. Where's the? So they bought the card, right? But then you guys didn't receive the money till they actually use it. Or did I hear that incorrectly?
It's a distinction between unearned revenue and just having the actual revenue recognized. Mm-hmm. So while we did receive the funds, we categorize them and account them as unearned.
So it's an accounting
issue. It's just an accounting term.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Oh, yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. So I just want to make sure I'm completely – this is basically you trying to preempt a future problem – but it has no fiscal impact because this has nothing to do with whether or not you have these systems, you get the funding and have these systems approved. This is if you get the systems, if you get all the funding for that, this is trying to prevent a problem from happening later.
Yes, Representative Stark, we're currently developing the system today, and in 2016 we will begin to implement that system within the region. And as soon as we implement that, as soon as that first customer starts loading value onto their account, that's when the problem starts. And so we're just preempting that by solving it today, knowing that this is going to happen as it does at other similar projects in the U.S.
Can I follow up?
Go ahead.
For me, would you outline real quick, I buy a card and so forth, at what point would you be able to reclaim that money? Under what circumstances, if this goes forward, can you reclaim that money, and what's the timeline on that?
So, Representative Stark, it's a great question. The actual policy decision on if this House bill passes, we'll have to firm that up on what the direction will be. So an example could be that after a customer loads value onto that card, if after 3 years, for example, they do not use the stored value on that account, then we could deem that as the ability to recognize that revenue and say they've moved or they're no longer going to use transit. So there are many different policy decisions on how to handle it from that point. You can leave it there and let it sit on the balance sheet and wait for them to claim it. You can have fees to reduce it, or you can just recognize it as revenue at that point and remove it. So many different models out there. But the bottom line is that we would wait a certain period of time and to determine that the customer just isn't going to use it.
So I just wanted to follow up a little bit more on I think my only concern with a bill like this would be the folks, and I think Representative Stark kind of was touching this, of folks that we could, get a hold of and return that money to them. So is there, And I guess the question is, under the proposed legislation, there would be no requirement for TriMet or any other entity, because this applies, I think, more broadly than just to TriMet as well. Under those circumstances, then there's almost an incentive for TriMet or other entities to sit back and not try and reach out if there is, you know, a more significant balance on there, because you know that the money's just going to come to you. And so what's in place to kind of protect the consumer from, you know, or from, I guess, just inaction, because we know the money is going to come to TriMet, or my understanding is this would also apply to some other different types of cards as well, outside of the situation. So,
Vice Chair Rayfield, it's a great question. So nothing in this bill has that action to state at this particular time something has to happen. I think the general notion was that the customer at any time can come back and say, hey, I've got balance left on my account. I'd like to get a refund for that. I think we would like to, from a policy perspective, look at how do we at some point end that time period. And since there's nothing in here, it would be a policy directive of, say, 3 years or 5 years or maybe even indefinitely, that we just leave it there. But the idea is that we're able to not give those funds back to the state at the three-year mark and instead keep them and reinvest them in transit.
I think I would, you know, probably be in favor of some sort of addition on there where there's a reasonable effort has to be made to find the owner of the funds. As funds go to the Department of State Lands, they actually have an entire those folks actually are searching for whose property this is and trying to return that property to them. Although, I mean, this is probably some small balances, not really a big deal. I think I'm more concerned with kind of the conflict of interest that's present, where inaction of a large, you know, some amount of money, you know, if you just sit there, it just goes back to the end of it. It goes back to TriMet. So, yeah, that would be my only concern.
Representative Rayfield, that is a good question, and I know we've thought about that at TriMet. I think another way of looking at this would be if you bought a book of 10 tickets and you decided not to use three of them, the revenue would still be with TriMet even if you had those 10 tickets. And then if you pulled three of those tickets back out and came back to us and said, we would like a refund on this, or I have these tickets, what can I do with it? We would exchange it for transit, more transit service. So it's this is because we're transitioning to that, it would be, I think, similar to that. This is just a little more complicated because we now know more detail about the person who bought those 10 tickets and how to. Am I making sense?
No, and that's actually a really good clarification.
Other questions? Excuse me. Are you fine now?
I'm just reading a few.
Okay. There's a potential question bubbling. That's why I'm waiting.
Heels are turning.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3062 and open a work session on House Bill 3062. And I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3062 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 3062 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
So just to throw out there, I think that some of the questions that, you know, Rep. Rayfield and such brought up, potential dangers of this in the future is why the current law exists, you know, on this type of thing. However, I think this is a unique circumstance, and I like that they're coming in and being proactive on this and trying to say we want to make sure there isn't a problem. If it turns into a problem, I suspect someone will be back, but I'm pleased that they're here trying to avoid future problems and identified this early on.
Yes. Further discussion? Yes.
I was having a little bit of a problem feeling comfortable voting yes for a minute, but I think the last answer was what will carry me into the comfort zone, and that is basically that if they're proactive about having something left, then they are going to take care of that person when they come in, and they will refund it. And if that wasn't so, then I'd have a problem with it. But I think what they're trying to do is be able to do business and plan and just not know, when do we get to stop waiting for them to use this particular ticket. It's like having an expiration date. And so I feel comfort with that.
Further discussion?
I think when I look at this, I mean, it is a, you know, it only deals with prepaid transportation cards, and so it's not broader. But I think there is another interesting concept where there are, you know, as you look through the statute, gift cards or other things where people pay money into this, and that's if someone leaves a $50 balance, a $75 balance, there is no incentive for these folks to return that money. As it's exempted, from my understanding of the reading of these statutes, and so that is. And then I think the other thing that you got to be conscious of is that when these folks get the money back into their pockets, say some of these other type of non-prepaid transportation cards. So I'm not speaking about TriMet or anybody else like that. That is money that, if someone didn't claim it, actually would go into our common school fund. At the end of the day, and right now it goes back to the businesses that have actually been paid for that money, so they're getting a double profit on it, and so that to me is a little bit of a concern. So, but this to me, as I looked between the difference between should this money go to the common school fund or go to the transportation, clearly these folks want and are investing in transportation, and therefore I think it makes sense to have that money go back to the unclaimed money go back to TriMet. So,
further discussion? Okay, seeing none, will you please call the roll?
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bueller?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, with that, the motion passes. Representative Stark, would you like to carry that one?
Sure.
All right, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3062. And I think we're waiting for people for our next. Is Paul Cosgrove in here? Do you want to? Could we do at least talk about your amendment while we're waiting for Representative Witt? So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2532.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers and Oregon Financial Services Association. As you may recall, this is a bill that Representative Witt showed a couple of ads from national companies. Those companies aren't banks. And when we talked to him about trying to narrow the bill so it didn't adversely affect the local lenders that are regulated by the state, we came up with this suggestion, which is the dash one, which it leaves into the bill, coverage in the bill, the very people that he was concerned about in terms of those ads. It exempts from the bill state-regulated and national chartered banks, credit unions, and other state-regulated financial institutions, some of which do reverse mortgages, but none of them do advertising like that.
Thank you very much. So that's the dash one?
That's the dash
okay,
one.
Okay, great. And you said Representative Witt is great with the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Paul. Yeah. Or actually, it looks like you didn't get off that easy.
Oh, sorry.
From Paul to Paul is the question.
So did I hear you correctly that you're exempting the state chartered and federally chartered institutions from this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, we're exempting the regulated financial institutions, whether they're state or federal. The entities that are doing the advertising that he's concerned about are non-regulated lenders. And it's legal to make mortgage loans without certain kinds of licenses, in particular first mortgages. But we're exempting the people who have licenses to do that and are regulated to do that and whose advertising is therefore overseen by a regulator.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you for that. I was kind of wondering, I guess from my look at it, that the regulated financial institutions are are already covered for misleading advertising as I understood it. So I was kind of curious what the need for this bill was. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, there are unregulated financial entities, we won't call them institutions, I guess, that are doing this type of advertising, and that's legal to do without a license?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, there are exemptions to licensure for certain kinds of mortgage lending in Chapter 80, if I recall correctly, 80 or 82. And yes, you can make certain kinds of loans without having a license. None of the people we're exempting are in that category. They all have licenses and are regulated, as you suggested. And their advertising is therefore overseen by a regulator.
Hmm. Interesting.
Did you want to have a follow-up to say interesting?
Follow-up? Interesting.
Where's it going to start?
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I might just be redundant here, repeating what all three of you have just said, but it may be changing my vote on this right here, this specific item. So I'm trying to understand. So the videos that were shown to us previously, if those had been done by, you know, U.S. Bank or any other current finance, when I think go to the bank, the types of banks we're thinking of, if those had been done by them, there already would have been regulation and they would have, you know, gotten some sort of a slapping on the hand to begin with. But those types of ads are only because there's an exclusion to certain types, and this basically removes that exclusion or applies to them.
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, I followed you to that last cut.
Me too.
You are correct that U.S. Bank and all of those kinds of lenders that you know and see on the street are regulated by a financial regulator, sometimes many financial regulators. In the case of banks, there are several, and their advertising is subject to oversight. So you're correct. The two entities that were shown, those are not so regulated by the state or the federal government in the same way. So that's why they're left in the bill. All the people whose ads are regulated are taken out of the bill by the Dash 1.
So it's no longer redundant.
Correct.
In that sense.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Witt's here.
Representative Witt, do you want to come? I mean, he's not able to answer your questions. Is
no.
From you? I mean, maybe. Go ahead and come up, because I think Representative Holby has a question.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31. And I just came in, so I'm not exactly sure where you all are at this point.
We're in the work session on 2532. Mr. Cosgrove was just telling us about the Dash 1. And I think if you want to just, Representative Holby, I think it's a very specific question.
All right.
Right. So we're kind of understanding Mr. Cosgrove saying that the Dash 1 makes this bill not apply to federally and state chartered institutions because they're basically already covered for this kind of misleading advertisement, I believe. And so my question is, has Department of Consumer Business Services confirmed that for you?
I have had those discussions, Madam Chair, Representative Holby, earlier. If you'll remember back to the videos that we showed, mm-hmm. With the initial presentation, and my description of the problem, again, my problem has never been with the product or the people that offer the product, but those who advertise the product, which tend to be national advertisers and not people who are chartered here by the state and I'm led to understand by national charter as well, although I am not, I really haven't gone into the national portion of it in terms of charters. So it is with the advertisers
mm-hmm.
who present that information, and they must, the request from the bill is essentially full disclosure.
Okay. Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So the Division of Finance and Securities doesn't think that they have authority over this kind of advertisement in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, I have not posed that specific question, and nobody has, that I am aware of, has presumed that they do have that authority, but I have not posed that specific question. So
yeah.
I think the assumption is that it's not
that
there.
That they don't, yeah. Thank you. I'm good.
Thank you with that. Do you think, is there anything else you'd like to add? Or
okay. That's it,
great.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I'll take a motion to do the dash one.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2532, dated 2/27/2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated February 27th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Okay, seeing none, so adopted. And with that, I will entertain a motion on the bill as amended.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2532 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 2532 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call. Oh, excuse me, Representative Rayfield.
Yeah,
Stark.
Thanks, Chair. I came in here planning on being a no on this because I felt like it was redundant. I believe in what was just presented to us, and hopefully the experts would scream at me sooner than later if I'm in error. But I'm now, as it has now been explained, this is to deal with the part that is not currently covered and therefore is not redundant. And so that convinced me to move forward on it.
That's my understanding as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative
Newman? Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Buehler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Volpe?
Aye.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, with that, the bill passes. And as far as a carrier is concerned, is there anybody? Oh, actually, I bet Representative Witt would like to carry it.
That would be fine, Madam Chair. If there's a member of your committee that you would prefer, I'm open to that.
I didn't see anybody jumping out of their seats, and so it's all yours, Representative Witt. Okay with that. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2532 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2528. And you want to go ahead and come up again, Representative Witt, and Wendy will give us a summary.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2528 establishes a task force on citizen review of public works projects. It specifies membership of the task force and directs the task force to study the need for and feasibility of establishing a review board to review, approve, and oversee public works projects. The bill directs the task force to submit a report to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly relating to public contracting no later than September 15, 2016. The bill declares an emergency as effective upon passage. It sunsets December 31, 2016. It's been found to have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31. Appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2528, this is a bill that establishes a task force on citizen review panels. And the intent of the bill was for state public works projects. And I will tell you that the bill does not specify that at this point and will necessitate an amendment to make that perfectly clear, that this bill is directed only at state public works projects. Excuse me. The reason for the bill is the litany of public works, for the lack of a better term, snafus over the past couple of decades. That I believe have damaged the public's faith in state government, have cost the taxpayers literally hundreds of millions of dollars, and have been a source of great embarrassment for a number of folks. A few examples of these problems, beginning back in the 1990s, with the $56 million computer upgrade of the DMV computer at a cost of $56 million that was ultimately scrapped in 1996. And I think a lot of people would suggest that the computer system is still in dire need of upgrade. Also, the Eddyville bypass that's been going on now for about a decade. It was a project that's intended to straighten out about a 5.5 mile stretch of Highway 20 between Corvallis and Newport. The project was initially estimated to cost about $205 million. Current estimates run about 175% of that. Then there was the state data center, SNCC, rather, which stands for Computing and Network Infrastructure Consolidation. This project of a decade ago was intended to house the data centers from 12 state agencies, and that was projected to cost or bid at $63.6 million. While it was completed, and maybe one of the more successful projects among the group, it was nonetheless a security nightmare in terms of data security. I was a first-term legislator, and I sat on the committee that had oversight in the House of Representatives for technology, and the information that we got over the course of many months scared me, I think, quite literally. In terms of the security of our state's data, and I will also suggest to you that it was a consolidation fiasco, if one were to believe all of the many phone calls that I receive from various state employees saying that this consolidation is just upside down. And then, of course, that leads us to most recently Cover Oregon. It's recent enough that I don't need to go into the details. $300 million is enough of a let me just say, though, that I am also concerned that the project's contracts lacked strong accountability mechanisms and that we couldn't ensure delivery of a working product. Madam Chair, members of the committee, these are some of the larger and more egregious problems. There have been others. We can do better. We have to do better. The public expects us to do better. And I have to tell you, I never want to have to cringe again when a state public works project is proposed under state of Oregon oversight. It harkens back to the nuclear bomb test when I was a little grade school kid, duck and cover. I mean, I want to run and hide. It's we have to find a better way, and I'm not sure that we get to find that other way unless we are able to call in experts from the public who can assist us with this type of oversight. While the bill leaves it up to the task force to decide the mechanism of how that oversight looks, I really would prefer personally that these oversight panels have people called on a project-by-project basis so that we have experts, should it be the Eddyville project, that we have experts in road construction and bridge construction. And Representative Nierman visited that site with me. And if it's something perhaps to do With medical coverage that we have experts in that. If it's something to do with the computerization and consolidation, that we have experts in those areas. But we have to do a better job. We cannot continue down this path of major fiasco after major fiasco. I ask for and urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Witt. Yes, Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Representative Witt, this looks like a good plan. So there's it's an 11-member thing panel here. Three members of which are residents of the state with particular expertise or interest in public works contracting issues. And I'll think out loud here. I'm not even sure if this is even a bad thing. But do you run into a problem where you say you appoint somebody to the – or the governor appoints somebody to the panel that is an expert in road construction or something like that, and then they end up overseeing a computer software project or – vice versa, some nerd from a computer software background doesn't even own a pair of hiking boots, and is that a problem, or do you see any issues with that?
Madam Chair or Representative Nierman, that's precisely why I just described. I would vastly prefer that the task force, although it's whatever product they produce, I'm happy to live by it. I believe in the product that task force members come out with. But I think it would make sense to convene panels on a project by project basis to try and avoid that specific kind of problem that you just described, because yes, that would concern me. Were we to convene a panel with the wrong set of experts for the project that would be that they would be advising the state on.
Thank you.
Yeah, for the record, I do not want nerds working on bridge projects. I don't know.
The right kind of nerds, maybe.
The right kind of nerds. Other questions for Representative Witt? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thanks. I was just trying to get a handle on this a little bit, because it's talking about, you know, IT projects and a lot of other things. I was wondering about does the definition of public works include those sorts of projects that you're talking about?
I believe, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, that they do. I've tried to draw the line in my own mind between actual projects and construction that may occur with the aid of state money. And I wanted very much, actually, to talk in my presentation about Betsy, but I believe that didn't fit within the parameters of a public works project. It was tax credits, obviously, and so the state was not actually determining a specific project. So that's the delineation, the demarcation that I've drawn in my own mind. It may not be perfect, but that's how I've grappled with this.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Holby, follow up?
Follow up, yeah. I appreciate that. I was just wondering, it seems like public contracts would be a broader term instead of public works projects, and maybe would, you know, be able to cover the whole scope of things.
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, when I first was thinking about this bill, that's where I went to, and as the bill was being drafted, I pulled back from that.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I represent what I share your concerns and appreciate you putting so much thought and effort into this, and you forgot another major project called Owen, which is
yes, thank you,
which has also gotten, unfortunately, a lot of press and
yes,
hundreds of millions of dollars spent and still, I think, on the barely implemented. I wonder if there is a time when the legislature had an audit committee, and it's in statutory law already, but and I'm new to this process, but I don't see our legislature having a functioning audit committee, and I just wonder if we did have a functioning audit committee, many of these functions could be incorporated into that committee. And I guess my question is, why isn't that committee functioning now, even though it's in statutory law? And maybe that's an open question to my more senior representative members.
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, I can't answer that specific question. I simply don't know the answer to it. I'm glad that you brought up Owen because I skipped over it. My presentation actually it had intended to address that. I sat on the Ways and Means sub when that came before the legislature initially. And I have to tell you that we were led to believe, I maybe can't speak for everyone who was on the subcommittee at that time, but I truly believe that we felt good that we were creating a system that was going to enable interoperability communications throughout this state, and if there was a major disaster, we could have virtually every emergency responder in this state able to communicate across the state. It made perfectly good sense. You know, a lot of us had questions. Every time we had a question, we were assured that it was the best. We were on top of it. We were doing it. You know, we had all the right eyes on it. Would that committee be helpful? Absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't know how those of us who are not experts in either contract bidding, engineering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know when you're sitting there as a legislator and you're asking questions, much as I did with Scenic, much as my colleagues did with Scenic, and you're constantly assured, oh, it's all is well and all is good. Unless you have that expertise, I don't know how you get to the heart of these people have questions. These people are telling me, oh my gosh, the sky's fallen. And, you know, in committee we're told, no, everything's good, everything's fine. I've come to the belief, based with on personally sitting on committees, first Scenic and then Owen, that we need that outside expertise that comes in here and says, you know, that question that you just asked is valid. It is a valid concern, and let me tell you why it's a valid concern, rather than it's always good.
Thanks, and you know, I really appreciate this effort. You know, I've always been sort of, I guess, disappointed in some of the projects and how they went forward. And you know, and sometimes it's not always our state agencies that run afoul, but it is the experts they hire, as you know. And so it's kind of hard. I know the Eddyville project, for example, we used to have in-house engineers at ODOT, and we decided to contract all that out. And then we ended up hiring to the low bidder from out of state to do all that, and a low bid contract from out of state to actually do the work. And, you know, and so we're believing those out of state or those outside experts, and we don't have the expertise left within our agencies to do that. And so I think it's a systemic problem that needs to be addressed at some level. I don't know exactly how to turn that clock back, but you know, I'm not sure how this review board made up of the legislature was, you know, which experts are they going to believe? It seems like a daunting task, but one that we really need to figure out and think about. I agree.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, when you mentioned that, I looked right at Representative Merriman, because, I mean, we pretty much heard that here a couple of weeks ago. And I mentioned in my presentation, Eddyville, you know, it's a decade old now.
Right.
2 years of that decade, folks were kind of, you know, scratching their heads and, you know, this isn't working. But it was a public contract, and we were well into the contract, and we had a contractor. And, you know, who makes the decision? People were concerned. People were very concerned, but nobody wanted to take that step, you know, and pull the rug out from underneath the project, because we were so far along. We had the experts. We had the contractor. And who steps in then to pick up what's left? And I'm not saying that this is a panacea, and I'm not saying that necessarily a public review panel would have made a decision to pull the plug earlier than the 2 years. But I sure think another set of eyes of outside experts may have advised us to pull it sooner than we did.
And I'm not sure that eval is as straightforward as you described, because it was Department of Transportation that decided to design, build, project. It was them accepting the degree of engineering that was done before the project was decided upon. So it's not quite that straightforward, but nor here nor there. It should be this. Don't you think there should be some limit on the size of the scope of the public works project that they review? Because you could get into, you know, very small projects unless we give some guidance with regards to
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, thank you for that that question, because I omitted that portion as well in my testimony. I do believe that there should be a minimum threshold, and were you to ask me that, I can't tell you today because I don't know. I'm not well enough qualified to know that.
Yeah.
I think plus or minus somewhere is in my mind maybe a $60 million project or greater.
Yeah.
But again, I would hope that the task force comes up with a recommendation on that figure. And I agree with you absolutely, yes. There needs to be a threshold. Otherwise, we're impaneling review panels for what could be de minimis projects, and that makes no sense either.
Yeah, follow up, and I still didn't get an answer to the Legislative Audit Committee. Is that not functioning still?
Yeah.
Or what's the status of it?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, that's the one that I said, as far as I know, it's not operational. Okay. And why it's not operational, I simply do not know.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, I really appreciate the work, and I think it's important as we look at some of the history that you brought to us today. I think that one of the basic abilities for us having better projects is to have better criteria as far as what our public contracting is. And so I don't think that a review committee is going to do all of the work. I think we have to really get into it and really start looking at that criteria for public works. As Representative Hovey points out, you know, was it a low bid? Was it for some kind of a product delivered? Was there, you know, due dates? I mean, there's criteria for what you get. And so you have to look at the contracting criteria to really straighten up your process. But I do believe that any time you have another set of eyes, as long as you give them a concrete and you give them a real directed opportunity to look at a project, that also helps. So I support this in the essence that we're trying to have better review and we're trying to bring the public into the process. And the example that I would give is that I was involved with helping to pass two very large park measures. And then we had to take the money that the public had entrusted to us and had to actually buy property for green spaces in the future in our state. And one of the best things we ever did was a citizen review group that actually reviewed those buys and reviewed, you know, what we were trying to do, so that the public felt informed, they felt involved, and they were trying to make sure there was equity for all parts of the region. So I support this, but I don't think it's the end answer. I think we've got to look at the contracting code. Maybe not this committee, but we've got to put it in the appropriate spot, and some of us have to be willing to work on it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And is that all you have? Okay, so we have one more person. Tracy, do you want to come up?
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And just as Tracy's coming up, just for purposes of, you know, clarifying the discussion, I think, you know, in fact, the discussion we've had shows the need for this bill, which just creates a task force to study the creation of the board. So, you know, these are all valid concerns. How big of a size of a project does it need to be, you know, et cetera, because this bill is just establishing a task force that the task force will be, you know, given the project of actually looking at all of these concerns. So go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities, and I think that I can make this very brief. I think I drew the short stick on behalf of local government to get up here and indicate our concern. The way the bill was drafted originally was very broad, so hearing from the representative that there may be amendments coming to narrow those to impact state contracting agencies for us would alleviate some of those concerns.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. Rutten? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Or is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2528? All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2528. And so I guess we're not looking at it today if he's looking at amendments. Correct. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3052. And Wendy, will you give us a summary?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3052 requires that a contract for public improvement require a contractor to use biodegradable lubricants in operations related to the contract. It requires the contractor to have similar requirements for subcontractors. It requires the Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, by rule to specify standards for biodegradable lubricants, considering at a minimum the impacts on water quality in determining which lubricants should be classified as biodegradable. The bill is operative January 1st, 2016, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage. It's been found to have no revenue impact, but may have a fiscal impact. Statement has not yet been issued.
Thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, that's North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3052 regarding biodegradable lubricants. The ideas behind this bill came from one of my constituents, who you know, Chip Shields. He works for a company that includes a product line of biodegradable lubricants, and since he has a conflict, he brought this idea to me to consider in the House. He helped me understand this issue and assemble my testimony a bit for today, but I'm not going to acknowledge that I'm an expert on these lubricants at all. Over the past 25 years, there have been significant advances in the technology and performance of biodegradable lubricants. For example, Penn State University has used biodegradable hydraulic fluids in its mobile equipment and elevators since 2003. Their maintenance department has found the biodegradable hydraulic fluids have performed well with no performance problems related to their use. No additional maintenance, such as filter changes, has been required. Analysis has shown a decrease in friction and wear compared to petroleum-based hydraulic fluids. No change in viscosity and no oxidation. Virtually all of the major and many minor lubricant manufacturers carry lines of biodegradable lubricants today, particularly in the hydraulic fluid product lines. I'll submit some of my prepared remarks for the record and include links to the technical data sheets of Chevron Clarity, Mobil EAL, and Shell Naturel. Today, construction companies are sometimes required to use biodegradable lubricants in environmentally sensitive areas, but there is much confusion among the Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA, the Coast Guard, the ODOT, and the DEQ about what is environmentally acceptable in lubricants. Oregon law doesn't do anything to cut through it. Just that's one of the reasons that I'm bringing this forward. And because of all that confusion, there's a lot of misinformation on the construction sites about what is an environmentally acceptable lubricant. That's because there are different standards for biodegradability. There's a readily biodegradable standard. There's an inherently biodegradable standard. There's a primary biodegradation standard. There's an ultimate biodegradation standard. There are ASTM tests. There are OECD tests. There are EPA tests. There's a question as to whether bio-based products should be subject to the same Sheen rule as petroleum products to determine whether spills are reportable. Companies need clarity regarding the appropriate standards for a given application or a setting. There is currently no definition or standard in Oregon statute for biodegradable or biodegradability as it relates to hydraulic fluids or lubricants, and that means that finding a standard to apply is convoluted and imprecise. But if these bio-based products are good for the environment in environmentally sensitive areas, aren't they good for all of Oregon's lands and soils? The reason this issue is important for all of Oregon's lands is that hydraulic hoses and seals, which are common in mobile construction equipment, are notorious for leaks and blowouts. It's been estimated that up to 60% of all lubricants are not recycled, and that a large portion of the lubricant deployed ends up polluting our environment, often in ways that is not isolated or static. It should also be noted that for engine oil, the technology is not quite there. At this time, refined and synthetic engine oils are the most environmentally safe, not biodegradable oil. Biodegradable lubricants do cost more up front, but they require less expensive cleanup and usually generate less in fines assessed from environmental regulators. In other words, regulators reward construction companies for using biodegradable products when environmental cleanups are required. Those construction companies that do the right thing and choose to use biodegradable lubricants may be disadvantaged in the bidding process on the state-sponsored projects as things stand today due to the higher upfront costs. So the first part of the bill is to require biodegradable products on Oregon state-owned construction projects to better protect the environment. The second part is to instruct the state to bring stakeholders and scientists together to make rules about what standards construction companies should use. This will help construction companies cut through the claims of oil distributors, making them less dependent on vendors for information. So the technology exists. Biodegradable products perform well, meeting the specification of the overwhelming majority of mobile construction equipment in most applications. It will be good for all Oregon land and water, and it will help construction companies clarify claims made by oil distributors. So I urge your support for House Bill 3052, ask you to schedule it for a work session, and ask you to forward it to the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? With the caveat that he said he's not an expert. Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. That's fair enough on the expert part, but I'm curious how much environmental damage is currently done in the state of Oregon as a result of the non-biodegradable lubricants.
This is part of the reason that we need to have a good strong study. The DEQ does have some, and they may be able to tell you a little bit about that. I believe you may have somebody from the DEQ coming up after me.
Okay.
I think they are neutral on the bill, by the way, but they do have some direct information on that. They may.
Representative
Dierman. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Frederick, you said that the technology is not quite there for motor oils yet.
Not for motor oils yet. That's what I understand, yes.
I was looking through the bill. I didn't see any kind of specific exemption for that, but that seems like a pretty big usage of lubricants as motor oils.
That's true. We need to look at that particular issue, but we do have some. There are some biodegradable lubricants that are available at this point, and the motor oil thing is something that people are still working on. The companies that I mentioned are still working on, and I think did we send that? There's some links that you may have with you. If you haven't gotten them, we will try to get them to you. That can give you some of those products and what Shell and Chevron and Mobil are already presently using.
Can I follow? Mm-hmm. Thank you. So you say that the technology is not there for motor oils, yet now it sounds like you say that there are some motor oils that are available
there,
to do that.
There are some lubricants that are available. Sorry, Representative.
So when you say lubricants, so more specifically motor oils then, right? I apologize.
No, I understand what you're saying. This is a specific to some of the hydraulic work, and for some motor oils, for some applications, the motor oil is still an issue. But for most, it's not. You now can get biodegradable.
Can I follow again? Mm-hmm. So if I just have a dump truck or whatever I'm using on a public contract, and I need an exemption for the motor oils. In other words, I've got the hydraulic dump, and that's fine, and I use the biodegradable there. But the motor oil. So then I'm going to have to use the process described let's see, I don't have the bill up here anymore, but the process described in the bill to go get an exemption from the DEQ just to use that motor oil on site. Don't you think that that's going to be a little bit of an onerous process for every contractor to do or nearly
well,
every contractor?
Well, the idea is not so much that you have to do it each time. The idea is that when you're working on a site, they already know that you're going to be using certain things. I mean, this is to go into a particular project. Ahead of time, you would know that you need to use that ahead of time rather than waiting until you reach a particular point that you're in the middle of the project. So this is a bit of a preventative. The idea is that you would know before you landed on a project that you were supposed to be using biodegradable products there. So, I mean, if that helps, I hope that helps.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Neiman.
Mm-hmm.
And just to follow up, and reading through the bill, I don't believe, and you might be able to answer this better, I don't believe that there's any requirement for someone to get a permit. So if your machinery or equipment requires a specific grade or type of lubricant, you're not required to go to DEQ to get a permit. You're basically, as the contractor, you're kind of on the, in good faith, you're going to follow these rules. So there's not going to be an additional burden on DEQ. Is that the way I read this?
Well, there may be some burden on DEQ, and I think they may want to speak to that, because they're going to need to look at what materials are available. They may want to use the EPA listing for that, the marine listing for that, or some other system in order to determine what's biodegradable and what works. If you recall that I mentioned that there are so many different standards and so many different groups that are working with it. But the idea is what you're suggesting. You would not have to get a certificate from it, but in order to be part of a project on state lands, this would be something you'd want to use. And I apologize for not following protocol, Madam Chair and Representative.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up. So once DEQ makes the rules, then essentially the burden is off of them for the most part, unless they were to go to a site and find a violation.
Madam Chair and Representative Rayfield, I would assume that's the way that would work. One of the issues that we're still dealing with DEQ is frankly their capacity. They have only a certain number of people that they can go out and do that kind of testing and check with. But there are going to be some suggestions, and I am concerned a little bit about how we get. How we get the chance for them to really do the effective testing and evaluation of these products. But this is the idea is for them, for state projects, for them to have on state projects for people to already be ready to go, construction companies ready to go with this.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, thank you, Representative. And we.
Oh, one more. I did.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Fagan.
Oh, yeah.
Again, this may be above your pay grade on these specific topics. If it is, just want to put this out there that I'm looking for answers on these
good
questions. The one is you're talking with DEQ. I'm curious as to, I mean, how is it actually enforced? Does that create more positions or more of a financial burden on whichever agency we decide has to go out and inspect, and what's the fiscal on that? And then I've not read enough fiscals to know if this would be included, but I'm interested in, you said that it usually costs a contractor more to pay for the biodegradable fuel upfront, and therefore I would guess that bid price would be reflected. And so I'm curious on what we would predict our bids or our overall cost for these types of projects for the state to increase. So a lot to answer right now, but I would love for that information to come in at some point.
I appreciate that, and I will keep that in mind, some of those questions. I appreciate that quite a bit.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We have three more people that want to be heard on this bill, so let's hold our questions for them. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
So Tom, Rob, and Tracy. You guys, Rob and Tracy, you guys didn't mark on here if you're going to – are you guys neutral or –
opposed and concerned, I think, is what probably is
okay.
or at least concerned.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to – and DEQ is neutral, so I guess it's not altogether too strange of a panel. Go ahead.
thank you, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Tom Roik. I'm a policy analyst with the DEQ, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. DEQ is neutral on this bill, and my comments will actually be very, very brief. DEQ is very interested in moving Oregonians toward using less toxic and greener products. We commend the development and use of biodegradable lubricants, which is in line with our agency's toxics use reduction strategy, and we certainly support the use or the concept of the use of biodegradable lubricants. At the same time, I'll also admit that I'm not an expert in biodegradable lubricants. Currently, we do not have the expertise in-house to specify standards for biodegradable lubricants. And it has not been DEQ's role historically to specify standards for commercial products such as these. So there are several third-party businesses and organizations that can help with that. So some examples of that are the Pacific Northwest Pollution Prevention Resource Center, which actually may be able to help identify a business that could help certify or develop standards. The Northwest Green Chemistry Center, which is based in the state of Washington, which could also help with green chemistry in general and could help standards for these products. And then very recently, EPA, US EPA, has actually come out with a what they call safer choice labeling standard. So they have in-house scientists that applies health and safety standards to different products and determine whether or not they meet their healthy choice standard. So it may be DEQ's role in this process to help make those connections between those organizations which can actually establish standards and help implement them. Finally, as a caution, I'd like to say that even though moving to biodegradable lubricants may be a step in the right direction, if there are significant spills or releases of those products, there could very well still be environmental impacts to surface waters or biota. So we'd still emphasize the need to prevent releases and clean them up as quickly as we can. And I'll stop there.
Go ahead.
No.
You have an official position.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rob Bovette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. A couple of things. One is, as you'll probably note, this bill would apply to all public improvement contracts, state, local, and otherwise. It would apply to all lubricants, so there would need to be some sort of dressing of motor oil and others that aren't quite ready for prime time. We suspect that maybe it might be time to study this issue first before we jump off this cliff. But if you really want to jump off this cliff, we would also urge you to confine it to state public improvement contracts, and we can watch the state deal with this first. Maybe we can address this in the next session to see how it worked out. But we have very little doubt that this will drive the cost of public improvement contracts around the state up fairly significantly. And so we have those concerns. And as a result, we are opposed to the bill as drafted.
Thank you. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities. And in surveying our members on where they're at in this bill, I will state we don't have a very official position yet because I received a whole lot of questions, some confusion, some panic. It was all over the board. So it was very challenging for us. And so I think that what it did was sort of point me in the direction of saying we need a lot more clarity to make sure that if there are any standards, that they are easy to understand, folks know what the process is, and that we make sure that this isn't so broad that we have sort of an administrative side of this that's really difficult for the state through DEQ to manage. I get the unique position of representing from the public contracting side, but also I have the water portfolio for the league as well. So we've got wastewater providers, and they were intrigued by the issue, but they, again, would like to have some further information. This one wasn't very high on their radar of those top items that cause them the most concern in their operations, but we're certainly open to having some further discussions with Representative Frederick to see if we can't narrow this and send it in a direction that makes sense for the state.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel?
I yes. Can't help myself. I just want I want it to be noted on record that we had local partners that said the state should lead. Did you hear that? And they'll watch and take lessons, and it could all be good. I just thought that was a unique comment. You know, really and truly looking at, I think it's Section 4 and it's Subsection 2, this has basically been written to include a lot of other people at the state level besides the DEQ. I mean, you've got a lot of folks there, including the Transportation Department. And I may agree with our local folks that there's a lot to digest here. But it's always important, I think, to really get that first version out there so we can see what the opportunities are and what the partnering should be, and also what are the possibilities as far as looking at an interesting. And if you're getting items like concerned and or confusion, that means that there's more conversation to have. And so if you were looking at this, what are, you know, if this is the question, what basically is your biggest concern as far as the, you know, the breadth? I heard one comment as far as different types of contracting, but what is your biggest issue at this point so we know where to direct our thoughts?
Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, the questions, again, a lot of them were around in what scenarios does this actually apply. The other concern was, would this potentially impact any warranties for the equipment that we use or that we have as our own fleets?
Okay.
So that was another issue that was brought up.
Thanks.
Yes.
I just had a quick question for Mr. Wick. As we were talking about, you know, I guess in the initial presentation, there's a little bit more cost up front. However, the cost is less to clean up. And so you guys are the experts in cleanup. And so I just wanted to ask you, I mean, as far as lubricant spills or cleanup, what are you seeing as far as the state? And then can you subdivide that? What do you see as far as local or, you know, state projects as opposed to, you know, private and public?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield. So in terms of cost, it may be hard to speak to that in the sense that every incident is very different. And so I think we have to approach those separately and determine how much cleanup may be necessary in that regard. I'd have to answer your question.
How many incidents are there in a given year, private and public, with, you know, lubricant spills or that would require cleanup?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, off the top of my head, we respond to typically 1,500 spill incidents a year. How many of those are actually oil spills? I couldn't tell you right now, but we could get that information for you.
And that, I think that would be helpful. And then one follow-up, one more. As far as my understanding is, for a lot of those spills, you require the person who spilled it to actually pay the cleanup costs. Is that accurate?
Chair Fagan, Representative, that is accurate. We it's cost recovery for those types of spills where the person responsible for it would be expected to pay for the cleanup. Yes.
One last follow-up. Does the state, so if the state is contracting with a third party to do something, a spill occurs, does the state indemnify that third party and pay for those spill costs back to DEQ, essentially taking money from one pocket to the other, or does that third party have to pay out of their own bank account for those negligent spills, or I guess even non-negligent spills?
That's a very good question. My understanding is that, yes, the third party would be contracted with those who are responsible for the spill to do the work, and so they wouldn't be responsible to the state necessarily for that. They would be covering their own costs until they're reimbursed by the responsible party.
Madam Chair, may I respond to at least one question from Representative Rayfield, which is the number of spills. I would encourage DEQ to refine the look in the sense that it's not just oil spills. It's oil spills on public improvement contracts, and it's excluding motor oil. So we're really looking at lubricants other than motor oil spilled on public improvement contracts in the state of Oregon over the course of a year. And I suspect the number is going to be very small. That was some of the comments I got back from our public works directors. They just don't, they're really struggling to understand the problem attempting to be addressed by this bill.
I guess the other follow-up would be, what do we do with the statistic that 60% of all lubricants are not recycled? So what happens to that 60% of lubricants that aren't recycled?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, I'll try to answer that question, but we can do some research and get back to you. I think typically they're disposed of in different ways. They could be incinerated or even sent to a landfill potentially if they're not recycled.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3052? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3052. And so for purposes of time, we have in the room until 1:45. So we have one more hearing left and several people who'd like to be heard. So I'm not going to work this bill today, just as a initial matter. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2132. And Tom and Scott, go ahead and actually Tom, Scott, and Nance. Tom and Scott, we'll start with that. Well, actually, Nancy, go ahead and come up as well. I guess that makes sense since they're neutral. So just as a moment, please. So colleagues, let's, you know, try and, because there's then an entire panel of those that oppose the bill, too, so let's try to make sure that we keep our comments as brief as possible so that we can get through both panels and have a sufficient amount of time. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Linhares. I live at 740 Golden Pheasant Drive, Redmond, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I have over 30 years of experience in the property tax system. First of all, I need to apologize. My written testimony elevated Vice Chair Bueller to the chair's position, and I apologize for that. Just a silly mistake on my part.
Please.
Since we're running short of time and a lot of other folks want to speak to this bill, I won't read my testimony completely. County assessors brought this bill to your attention because we place a lot of taxes on the assessment tax roll, including assessment and fire patrol surcharges for the Department of Forestry. The administration of that program is significantly different than other amounts we put on the roll for other agencies and taxing districts, and in discussions with Oregon Department of Forestry, because of the way that assessment program works and the extra administrative cost, we just thought that it would be a good idea to get reimbursed for some of those extra costs. And my written testimony details some of the reasons why this program is harder to administer than other taxes and fees we place on the assessment tax roll. There are four counties that currently charge an administrative fee for doing this work, and that's because they've been charging a fee for as long as anybody can remember. I'm not sure anybody really knows when they first started. My compliments and admiration to the Department of Forestry. They've continued to allow those four counties to charge a fee. The fees range from 0.25% of 1% to 0.57%. We're asking for a maximum of 1% of the total taxes we collect for Department of Forestry. In all likelihood, not all counties would charge an administrative fee, and for those counties that do charge a fee, many or most would not charge the full 1%. If all 35 counties did charge the full 1%, the amount would come to a little over $201,000 if that would have been available to counties this current fiscal year. The amount changes a little bit over a year. So again, I'm not going to read the rest of my testimony. We feel this is a fair and equitable bill. We've talked briefly and only recently with the forest landowners about the fact that a good share of this would be passed on to them. Unfortunately, it's only been recently that we've reached out to forest landowners, and I take responsibility and apologize for not doing that sooner. But we look forward to continuing to work with the Department of Forestry and forest landowners, either this session as hopefully 2132 continues to make its way through the legislative process or during the interim as we continue to deal with this problem. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Langton. I'm the Deschutes County Assessor, and I'm also representing the Association of County Assessors. I'll be very brief on this, follow up on Tom, that basically with this, you know, we do have the inconsistencies on some counties charging and some not. And this came to a head a couple years ago where there was some ONC counties that were not charging. They were looking to how they were going to fund their assessment and taxation function. They wanted to be included, and Department of Forestry, because there was no consistency or the statutory language, said no. We've been working with the Department of Forestry for a little over 2 years on this issue, and it didn't appear that there was going to be able to be resolution or direction without legislative action on that. That's the reason it's before you here. And I guess this is different than a lot of other fees that we put on. We have an ad valorem property tax system. That's, you know, you're according to value, we're putting a rate on there. The system was designed for that. When we put fees on, we're, even though it sounds simplistic, with the interlocking statutes and the way they play together, especially with Department of Forestry, Fire Patrol, it creates a lot of administrative complexities. I mean, ideally, we would love to find a more simplistic way to do it where we wouldn't have that extra resource requirement and wouldn't need to be backfilled any administrative cost on that. But with the way the statutes are, this would be a way that we could offset those additional county expenses to implement the rule. So, and with that, I will end my testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch. I'm the Fire Protection Division Chief for Oregon Department of Forestry, and the department appreciates being able to testify today to provide neutral testimony, I might emphasize, regarding the financial implications of House Bill 2132, and specifically I'm commenting on the -2 proposed amendments. First, I'd like to recognize the working relationship that I think these folks have already characterized that our local forest protection districts have with each of their county assessors. As you also know, our department provides wildland fire protection on just about 16 million acres of forest land in Oregon. That includes private, county, state, and some federal lands. We provide this protection through a complete and coordinated system. And a primary source of revenue for this protection is a forest patrol assessment from owners of protected forest land. The county assessors have levied and collected significant portions of the forest patrol assessment on private forest landowners who are not members of a forest patrol association since about 1913, long-standing relationship. House Bill 2132-2 would allow counties to charge up to a 1% administrative fee for the county's work in the collection of assessments and surcharges imposed under statute. So based on the assumptions, and basically this is where the department's fiscal impact statement was based on the set of assumptions that if the counties did charge up to the maximum 1% administrative fee, on the statewide total imposed amount of approximately $21.3 million for fiscal year 15, the counties could charge the department approximately $213,000. For the 2015-2017 biennium, that amount would be $425,000, assuming the rates were flat for 2 years. In order to maintain an adequate level of fire protection and pay the counties these charges, they would have to be considered a cost of protection, and the department would include the fee within the agency and the district budgeting processes. As required in statute, district budgets are established to provide for an adequate level of protection and result in a per acre rate to all landowners in the district. Generally, this total cost, this estimated amount of $425,000, would be split equally among private landowners, public landowners, and the general fund for approximately $141,961 each. Let me move to Section 2 briefly. This amendment includes a provision that would require the department to reimburse counties when they incur uncommon administrative costs. The term uncommon is not defined, and so we were not able to determine a fiscal impact. In closing, I would just emphasize, as the deliberations on this bill continues, I would offer that the department and the counties have recognized challenges in this process, both financial challenges to the counties as well as process challenges statewide. Accordingly, as Scott here had mentioned, there was a committee, ad hoc committee, that was formed back in 2013 to seek to gain efficiencies on this system. And I think if this bill continues to evolve, please note that we would be happy to continue to work collaboratively within that process. Thank you.
Thank you.
question for Ms. The amount that the surcharge, where it would be charged, does that go into the fire protection fund that is capped at $13.5 million? Does it come out of that portion of it, or does it come out of the portion that funds basically the fire protection services?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, it's a little bit complicated, but it would actually touch in two places. When we talk about providing an adequate level of protection, that's really the base budget that the legislature funds us for, and really provides the fire department. So there would be an increase and a change to the rate that individual landowners were paying if this fee was imposed. And secondly, we actually need to look a little bit further, but there would be a potential shortfall to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund that may require a charge that ODF would, Department of Forestry would bill through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. We don't have that number or that detail quite figured out yet.
So in either case, it would require some general fund investment if we pass this.
That's correct, Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield. The amount for the biennium was estimated at about $141,000 for the general fund.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. It's Tom, right?
Yes.
All right. Just wanted to clarify a couple questions, because as I listened to you and I, you know, typed in a couple questions, and then I listened to, I forgot your name in the center.
Scott.
I apologize, Scott. It seemed like you guys said different things, and on at least on one portion. Tom, when you were testifying, it sounded as though you said you had yet to meet with the OFD, or you know, the Forest Department, and that you look forward to working with them in the future and maybe in future sessions as this works its way through the process, as though you didn't intend it to go anywhere just yet. But it was a starting conversation. And Scott, when you talked, you said you've been working with them for 2 years. So I'm curious, so have you guys actually worked with them on this bill? Where's that situation? Because obviously they will have things to say about this.
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, what I said, or maybe I didn't say it well enough, is we've been meeting with the Department of Forestry, and I apologize for only recently beginning a dialogue with the forest landowners.
Okay, so they, sorry.
And so it's that group that I would particularly like to continue to have a conversation with, because it's only been the last couple of weeks that I've reached out to them to discuss the impact of this bill on forest landowners. But we've been meeting with the Department of Forestry for a couple of years.
And so am I understanding correct that you're expecting a lot more dialogue on this with all parties involved before we actually move forward on this?
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, that's absolutely true. I would love it if we would continue the dialogue as House Bill 2132 moves through the legislative process.
Okay. And with speaking of dialogue, actually, I'm just going to, because I want to make sure that they do have a chance to speak. So thank you very much. So Roger, Heath, and Jenny, go ahead and come forward. Sorry, Representative Ryan. Yeah, I just want to make sure that we've only got about 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure they should be heard.
Should this be subsequently referred to Ways and Means and not Revenue?
Okay. We're not working today, though. Go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I work for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And as this is the first time for me to appear before this committee, I might tell you a little bit about OFIC. We're the trade association that represents Oregon's larger industrial timber landowners. So we have about 50 members, and they own or manage about 5 million acres in the state of Oregon. As you can imagine, 5 million acres of forested land, we pay a fair chunk of the Forest Patrol assessments. Not to discount the other parties at the table, this is a large undertaking. So with that, and what's amusing to me is that using digital paper instead of paper, I just lost my notes. So I'll take a shot at this. What I would mention to you is that fire funding is really complicated. And Vice Chair Rayfield, as co-chair of the Natural Resources Sub, I think you're getting a taste of that. There's a very large conversation to come about, you know, how we approach fire funding in Oregon. This is one component. With regard to the forest patrol assessments that the county assessors help ODF assess, it's something that they've been doing since 1913, I think. The details aren't perfectly clear to me, and I'm by no means an expert on this issue, but I'm not aware of anything recently that would actually change the workload or the manner in which they implement this program, right? There's the forest land reclassification process, which is underway right now, where you are looking at what is appropriately considered forest land, what's appropriately considered development. But that aside, and that's a one-time effort as directed by the legislature, that aside, it's not entirely clear to me what the problem is we're addressing. To the extent that there's computer programming required to implement this assessment, that's been required all along, right, for decades. So, you know, the hard part about having not reached out to the forest landowning community is that we're left with a lot of questions. And I take Mr. Lenhares at his word that he intends to work with us on the problem going forward. As a final point, I would say that this money would be money that would otherwise be devoted to fighting fire, right? And as evidenced by the last couple fire years, that's a big deal in Oregon and demands all the resources we can devote to it. I would be very cautious about manipulating that program here to push fees off into other directions. So with that, happy to answer any questions.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. Today, Oregon Farm Bureau stands in opposition to House Bill 2132, which would allow county assessors to charge the Department of Forestry an assessment for the administration of forest protection districts. Our members pay the forest patrol assessments to protect range and timberland. And as Heath said in his testimony, Oregon has faced two devastating fire years in recently and is facing another high-risk year due to drought. Resources need to be put on the ground where they were intended instead of, I guess, put into the administration. We are also very concerned that private landowners, and I can speak for Oregon Farm Bureau, were not consulted in this process going forward and would ask for a work group to have those discussions before moving forward with this legislation. So thanks. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. So Heath mentioned that he represents the big landowners. I'm here representing the other guys, the small side. Our average ownership has about 100 acres of forest land and all across the state of Oregon. So I'm not going to repeat anything that Heath or Jenny just said. I'd just like to maybe point out a couple other questions and I guess that are unanswered. And I also wear a dual hat in this because I sit on a Forest Patrol Association Board, the Clackamas Marion Board. I served on that board for over 30 years, so I've served all capacities twice as president of the board. So I'm quite familiar with how this system works at the local level. And at the local level, these associations, which are all around the state, help to set the budgets and work with the local cooperators, who are the rural fire districts, in addition to the Department of Forestry and BLM, in order to protect our forest lands. So when the question was asked about whether this would affect the Forest Land Protection Fund and the $13.5 million cap annually on that, that's unknown at this time, because as this bill is drafted, you heard that the counties collect about $21 million for the state. That's out of a almost $44 million budget, total budget. Part of that budget goes into the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is statutorily capped at this spending at $13.5 million. So if you have to take part of this assessment that was supposed to go into that fund and not put it in that fund, would that be lack of money going in, or would that be money coming out? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know that anyone does without a lot more research on that issue. That's one of the many unanswered questions I think this bill poses. The other being the Department of Forestry in the Western Oregon protects BLM land, the Bureau of Land Management land, under contract. contract, and BLM pays a per acre actual cost charge. How would this bill affect that? Could the Department of Forestry actually pass those costs of the administration of collecting the private land funds onto the BLM? The Department of Forestry testified that the public landowners would share a third of the cost, but I'm not sure that they could do that because their BLM contract doesn't allow them to do that today. And I believe that they signed five-year contracts with the BLM, and I think we're about 2 years into the current five-year contract. If those if those costs couldn't be passed on, that doubles or raises significantly the amount to the landowners and to the general fund. So I think this bill probably poses or makes more unanswered questions than it purports to solve. Therefore, I would encourage you to ask them to work with us. They have not yet worked with us to try to answer some of these questions, and maybe bring it back at a later date. I'm thinking 2016 sounds pretty good, but that's my timeline, not yours. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative Nierman, did you want to direct your question to this bill?
No. Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Don't be shy now. We've got 5 minutes. Representative Holvey.
Thanks. I appreciate the testimony. I was kind of thinking of the same thing when I was looking at this. How does this impact money for fighting fires? And I think you correctly pointed out that that's a big issue. I'm curious, I suppose, of how much. Maybe I need to ask this the Ways and Means folks, but what percentage of the Forest Fire Protection Fund comes from the private landowners?
And actually, Representative Wolfe, I just asked a very similar question. 65%, according to the fiscal office, comes from landowners with improvements, and then there's 35% would come from non-improvement land, and so that was coming straight from the fiscal office going into the.
I knew I should have directed it to
Madam
him.
Madam Chair, I think I'd like to maybe address that. Representative Rayfield, I appreciate the answer. I think you're speaking of the Forest Land Protection Fund.
Correct,
Which is the Emergency Fire Cost Fund. If you want to talk about the base budget, and this bill is more dealing with the base district budgets. I think someone described it as the fire departments. So the forest landowners and the general fund pay for half the cost of the base cost, 50-50 by statute. Over time, over the last, and I don't know if you got your
since
chart with you. Since 1992, the forest landowners' share of that is actually almost 70% by the time you add in the other charges and the fire costs. So somewhere between 50 and 70% over the last 20 years is borne by the landowners of the base protection, and then you have the Forest Land Protection Fund, which pays only for large fires.
And we're actually, the state is, so for instance, if you own land, we're actually paying for 50% of that land. So for instance, on say your property, you're paying 50% of the cost of the assessment on your property. The state covers the other 50%, and then you have like state lands where we're paying 100% of the cost for those lands because those are our state property. So, and then it kind of goes on from there. So
let's see, it's a fun process. Did that burn up
enough
time?
Did you have a follow-up for Representative Rayfield?
No, Madam Chair. I'm afraid to ask him another question.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Again, more of a statement than it is a question. I can come up with a whole handful of questions for both panels that I think the answers are probably lacking at the moment. And so I would really encourage you guys, whether we have to do something formal to create a work group or however that works, I'm just hoping that these groups can really come together, dialogue a lot more on this, resolve a lot of the questions that I know you guys know are out there before we talk about it again up here. So just more of a statement.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think this is a larger discussion amongst a couple other committees as well, so I think there's definitely a large overshadowing issue here around what's our best approach to fighting forest fires, and trying to have that overall discussion with whether it's the Revenue Committee or the Ways and Means Committee as well. I'm not sure about the, because this policy, I think, discussion will impact both of those arenas.
Madam Chair, Heath Curtis with OFIC. I would also mention that House Bill 3213 is a bill being brought by the Rural Fire Protection Districts. It's presently in rural communities. That's a bill that would allow the Rural Fire Protection Districts to assess, well, to place the ad valorem tax on all of the properties within their district boundaries. So landowners are kind of being approached with how to pay for the assessors, how to increase payment for the Rural Fire Protection Districts, and also with this larger fire funding conversation. There's a lot going on here, and I think it would be a shame to deal with it in a one-off with this kind of bill.
All right, thank you. And with that, or did you want to answer me, Jenny? With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2132. And anything else for the good of the order? And I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Ooh, that is long.